Want to add my happy Father's Day to all you dads out there with a big exclamation point on all that Kenny said about it. And on the longest day of the year, no less. First day of summer, I remember Nancy and I 2 years ago right now being in the north of Scotland. You think today is long, it never got dark there. It's really something to be in a place that's always in some stage of lightness, whether it's in the daytime or the nighttime. Well, today we're talking about the human condition, sin in particular. And as I was anticipating speaking this morning, I remembered my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, and his favorite president, who was Calvin Coolidge. Coolidge was president from 1923 to 1929, and he was well known as a man of few words. In fact, his nickname was Silent Cal. Well, there's a well-traveled story about Silent Cal and a day on which he went to church, and as he emerged from the church building, after the service was over, he found this gaggle of reporters waiting to ask him questions, and the first one piped up and asked him, Mr. President, what did the pastor preach on today? And Coolidge stopped, and he said, sin. Well, what did he have to say about it? He was against it. Well, we would expect that, but it's an expectation that begs a question. If preachers, and those to whom they preach, are against sin, then what is it that we're for? Right? You see, anytime we talk about sin, we need to remember that it doesn't stand alone. Rather, it stands in contrast to that which is not sin. So, to begin a sermon on sin, what is sin? Well, it's evil in contrast to that which is good. It's immorality in contrast to that which is moral. It's impurity in contrast to that which is pure. It's whatever misses the mark of perfection, even if it's to the slightest degree, which means that sin is not understood according to a curve or a sliding scale. You know, I know I'm not, or rather, I know I'm bad, but I'm not as bad as that guy. No. Or according to public opinion. Well, I understand this was once considered bad, but not anymore. No, rather, sin is understood according to an absolute standard, and anything less than that absolute standard of perfection is unacceptable. The tiniest imperfection on a master stamper for vinyl records, the tiniest imperfection on a minting die for coins, the tiniest imperfection on a mirror for a telescope requires that each and every one of those things be thrown out because they're imperfect, they're unacceptable, they're sinful. For over a decade, the fabrication of the mirror for the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson was riddled with problems and imperfections. The glassworks in France struggled to cast a 4.5-ton defect-free blank. It took them years. The glass grinders took years to produce a precise parabolic curve in the mirror. And then once they finally got it up to Mount Wilson, the astronomers required time to figure out that the mirror needed to be acclimated to the temperature at which they would be using the telescope. Because, you see, apart from all these things, they'd be discovering planets that, in fact, weren't even there, but rather the product of a minuscule scratch or or curve or some other defect in the mirror. So to catch a perfect image, the telescope needed to be and still needs to be sin-free. Well, this summer we're reviewing our doctrinal statement. Weeks 1 and 2, we covered the doctrine of God, the person of God, the plan of God. Eric and I spoke to those. Weeks 3 and 4, we looked at the doctrine of Scripture. Kenny just mentioned that. God has spoken, and God has spoken that we might live. He and Fred talked about those. And then this week and next, we're considering the human condition, sin, which creates our deepest need for God. I'll be talking about that today. And then salvation, which meets our deepest need for God. And Rob Lister will address that next Sunday. So for now, here is the doctrinal statement at which we'll be looking today. We believe that God created Adam and Eve in His image, but they sinned when they were tempted by Satan. In union with Adam, human beings are sinners by nature and choice, alienated from God and under His wrath. And then next week, Rob will speak on, only through God's saving work in Jesus Christ can we be rescued, reconciled, and renewed. Well, as you can see, there are three main persons in this morning statement. There's God, you can see him there, Adam and Eve, and then there's each one of us. God creates, Adam and Eve sin or rebel against their creator, and then all of us as offspring of Adam and Eve, who are our shared multiple great-grandparents, we share the guilt as well as the effects of their sin. To put it in even simpler terms, and this is really the main point for this morning, God made it, we broke it, and we suffer for it. But as we begin to see at the end of this morning's sermon, and Rob's going to open the doors on this next week, the Lord fixes it. So let's consider these things as they come to us here in the statement. First of all, God made it. He created. And to begin, He created Adam and Eve. And He did that on the sixth day, last thing He made, and He did that as the crowning achievement of His work. But that's not all He did, because He created man and woman in His image. That is to say, as persons, with a personal sense of self-awareness or introspection, a personal capacity to reason, that is to make deductions and come to conclusions, a personal sense of right and wrong, to recognize good and bad. We even have personal names, right? My personal name is Randy. God's personal name is Yahweh. And He made us in this way as opposed to animals, right? Animals are oblivious to their surroundings. They're irrational in their thoughts, and they're amoral when it comes to right and wrong. Or to put it another way, we don't respond to things according to instinct like animals do. Our dear dog Scully, she just can't hide her feelings. I walk in from work, and she bears no sense of concern for how I might be feeling on a given day. She just starts wriggling around and spinning and jumping and licking me, and because that's what she does by instinct. Rather, we respond to things according to intention, like those who are created in the image of God. Now, as already mentioned, man and woman were the apex of God's handiwork, not only created in His image to be fruitful and multiply, enjoy fellowship with their Creator, enjoy the same with one another, to serve as stewards of creation over the entire world. But this was all to be done in an entirely harmonious and happy setting. Well, as I mentioned a few Sundays ago, really Eric kicked this off with the beginning of the series. As the only one of his creatures able to reflect on God's creation, I've never come home and found my dog sitting in the backyard meditating on just how wonderful her surroundings are and the God is by whom she was created. No, is the only ones able to reflect on God's creation, we can only think more magnificently about God. I mean, certainly King David, we read these words a moment ago. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set into place, I have to think to myself, what's man that you're mindful of him? And the son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings, crowned him with glory and honor. You've given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. So point one, God created man and woman in his image with all the rights, privileges, and responsibilities thereof. They were created, they were given their little graduation plaque, and off they went. But point two, Adam and Eve sinned. How did that happen? Well, our statement tells us they were tempted. They were tempted. Lately, I've been folding the Lord's Prayer into my daily prayer time. And there's a part in that prayer, you know it, that goes like this. And lead us not into temptation. Lead us not into temptation. Now, what that doesn't mean is, God, don't tempt me. Don't tempt me, God. No, rather what it does mean is, God, keep us from temptation. Keep me as close to the side of the mountain as you can. Don't let me get too close to the edge of the trail and the precipice thereof. Eugene Peterson put it like this, keep us safe from ourselves. J.B. Phillips wrote, keep us clear of temptation. The contemporary English version renders it, keep us from being tempted. Now, the mistake here is to reason as follows. Okay, if temptation is to be avoided, then I must oppose it. I must resist it. I must fight against it. To be sure, we must. But if this is all we do, then we make the mistake of the ascetic in Colossians chapter 3, to whom Paul writes, why do you submit yourself to those kind of regulations? Like, do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, according to human precepts and teachings. Now, these have indeed the appearance of wisdom. I mean, that seems like the right thing to do in promoting self-made religion, asceticism, severity to the body. And I mean, we get that, right? I mean, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. What doesn't kill you makes you better. But Paul goes on. But really, these things are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. Okay, I can hear you. You're not saying anything, but I can hear your thoughts. Okay, I get what you're saying, but I'm not entirely following what you're saying. Are you saying that we shouldn't resist temptation? That's a very good question. No, really, what I'm saying is, to avoid temptation, we first need to recognize what, or should I say, whom we're up against. That is to say, temptation, it's not impersonal, it's personal. We're not tempted by something, we're tempted by someone. And because temptation is personal, it's therefore neither random nor ethereal. What do I mean by that? It's not random, but strategic. It is custom designed to draw you in. And it's not ethereal, meaning it's not like a vapor or a haze or a mist or like a spider web, you know, that you walk into and I just got to get this thing out of my way. No, rather, temptation is substantial. It's rooted in the spiritual soil of human reality. And we know this, that temptation is not impersonal, but personal, because of the next bit in the doctrinal statement where we read, but Adam and Eve sinned when they were tempted by Satan. Satan. You see, our adversary is a personal being. Though not entirely created in God's image, he's nonetheless a personal being. In Genesis 3, you'll notice it. He tempts Adam and Eve by appealing to their personal desires. Divine authority in verse 1. Divine prerogative in verse 3. That is, not only being image bearers, but themselves image makers. You can be that. Boom, boom. You can make things in your own image. You can be God over all of this. He appealed to their desire for divine knowledge in verse 5. He wooed them. And he still tempts us in that way. But he not only tempts us by wooing, he tempts us by wearing and tearing us down. 1 Peter 2. Beloved, I urge you to abstain from the passions of your flesh, which wage war against your soul. James 4. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? Now, I mentioned this before, but it bears repeating here. The words wage war and at war come from a single word that we get the English term strategy from. Now, a strategy is neither impersonal nor random. A strategy is personal and deliberate. Armies win wars, teams earn championships, students score A's, not somehow. We just rolled the tanks out there, and the next thing we knew, we won the thing. It's amazing. No, they do all these things by way of a strategy, a battle plan, a game plan, a study plan. And the adversary knows the landscape of your interior life. He's not in any way like God. That is to say, he's not all-knowing, he's not all-powerful, he's not all-present, but he is well acquainted with the human condition. He's been there since the beginning of it all. He's well studied in our weaknesses. He's well suited to develop strategies that wage war within us and against us. So consider how the adversary tempted Jesus during his 40 days without food in the wilderness. Matthew chapter 4. On the one hand, he tried wooing him, right, with bread and relief and authority. But then, on the other hand, he worked at wearing and tearing him down, right? Approaching him in his human weakness, attacking him from three different angles, appealing to him from the Word of God, taken out of context. And that's why when Timothy received his ministerial charge in 1 Timothy 4, Paul commended him to wage the good warfare. And in 2 Timothy 2, as a good soldier. I was thinking about this morning, and I remembered a gospel song we used to sing when I was growing up. Maybe some of you sang the same. Onward, Christian soldiers, marching as to war, with the cross of Jesus going on before. And I think for some, you know, well, that's a product of post-war era, and everybody was thinking in, you know, military terms back then. And, you know, the terms like the church militant was much more popular. Okay, well, maybe it was. But you know what I see here? When we step out into our day, we're stepping into a battle. Soldiers waging war. And this is why, also why, when any of us are tempted by the adversary, we need to appeal to the one who is greater than the adversary, who has defeated the adversary. Paul tells us that is Christ in you. And John adds that he who is in you is greater than the one, the adversary, who is in the world. I really like what Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 10 when he said, "For the weapons of our warfare," that is against temptation and sin, "are not of the flesh." It's not just willpower and grit. No, but the weapons of our warfare have divine power to destroy strongholds and arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God. It's in this way we are able to take every thought captive from control of the adversary in order to obey Christ. And I know even in preparing for this morning, and if you've ever preached or taught the Bible, you know this, before stepping up to do this thing, your mind is just pummeled with all kinds of thoughts that distract from the task at hand, which is delivering God's word. No one's exempt. So when Adam and Eve sinned, it wasn't just a matter of violating a law. It was that, but more than that, it was fundamentally a matter of violating a relationship. It was a personal thing. It was a breach of trust. It was a relational offense. It was an utter catastrophe. Adam and Eve, our multiple great-grandparents, forsook obedience to their Creator in favor of obedience to an already fallen creature. And it profoundly affected them. Just read Genesis 3 and 4. And as a result, it profoundly affects us, their multiple great-grandchildren. And for that, you can just go ahead and read the rest of the Bible. Or you can just read Romans chapter 5. Sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. So just as we inherit physical traits from our forebearers, we also inherit spiritual ones as well. So point one, God made it. Right? He created Adam and Eve in his image. Point two, Adam and Eve broke it, and in that, we all sinned. Point three, we all suffer for it. Because by virtue of our relationship to Adam and Eve, their sin has affected us, and that's what brings us around to ourselves. And here's the final bit of our doctrine for today. You can read it there. In union with Adam, human beings are sinners by nature and choice, alienated from God and under his wrath. So we are sinners by nature and choice. That means we're not only rebels, but we're rebellious. We've acted on our innate makeup, who we are. Because it is who we are. It's how we operate. And it's why Romans 3 famously states, "For all have sinned and fallen short of God's glory." Psalm 14, "No one is righteous, not even one." And that sinful condition goes all the way back to our birth. No, before our birth. Psalm 51, 5, New Living Translation puts it like this, "For I was born a sinner, yes, from the moment my mother conceived me." We were created by a perfect God, but entered the world in an imperfect state. And as I noted earlier, because the Lord doesn't grade on a curve, but according to an absolute standard of holiness, we are therefore alienated from God. You can't even look at him. You cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. Exodus 33, 20. But by the same token, he can't even look on us. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. Habakkuk 1. And that, therefore, leaves us under his wrath. Because of our imperfect state, those who reject God's authority in principle live under his wrath. That's John chapter 3. Those who reject God's authority in practice live under his wrath. That's Ephesians 5. And those who reject God's authority over the course of their lives will find it to have accrued interest, if you will, paid out in full on the last day, the day of God's wrath. Romans chapter 2. Now, some say the tragedy of that day and the hell to follow is that men and women who were created in God's image will spend an eternity apart from him. So if God is love, then hell is not. If God is light, then hell is not. If God, by virtue of his Trinitarian nature, is communal, then hell is not. In fact, on these three counts alone, separation from God puts one in a place that is forever nauseatingly indifferent, dark, and lonely. But there are others who assert that because God is all-powerful, his power extends even into hell, where as judge over all things, men and women will be left to experience the full weight of his absolute holiness and justice and wrath. This is rotten. Either way, one scholar argues that in hell, a person's memory and unfulfilled desires will be intensified, causing profound torment. The lost are trapped with the perfect recollection of rejected opportunities and unending, unsatisfied cravings. That's horrible. That is horrible. But my question is, can you see it? Can you feel it? The weight of it? Well, gratefully, the gospel is the antidote to the horror of sin and its consequences. But here's the deal. The height of our gratitude for the gospel is proportional to the depth of our distaste for sin. So how much do you hate sin? Really? I mean, is it patently, palpably, viscerally horrible to you? Or has your love for this world diminished your ability to recognize sin's horror and in turn the mercy, the grace, and the love of God? Yeah, oh yeah, I'm all about the gospel and I'm against sin. But if it ends there, then we need to do some reflecting as human beings that we have the capacity to do about the fix that we're in and God's great goodness to us in Christ. Because how you answer that question is going to tell you a lot about where you stand or don't stand with the Lord. Because the fact of the matter is, we are dead in our trespasses and sins. For all the years I was a funeral director, there was not a body I worked on that gave me any help. And taking off their clothes, putting on their clothes, picking them up, putting them in the casket. Dead people don't do anything for you because they're dead. Dead is dead. And to be raised from the dead requires an infusion of life which comes from the only one who conquered death, who is life himself, Jesus Christ. And Rob is going to fling the doors wide open on him next week. But as we conclude this morning, I want to tell you two little stories that accentuate the deadness of death as a result of sin and the joy of new life. And I want you to ask yourself, as you're listening to these stories, does the wonder that these two stories elicit in any way approximate the wonder I have for the work of Christ in my life? Story one. 20 years ago, I attended a funeral visitation for a Taylor University student. I used to work at Taylor. I was the campus pastor there. A Taylor University student by the name of Whitney Sirach, who along with four others had been killed in a tragic auto accident out on Interstate 69. I have very distinct memories of driving up to Gaylord, Michigan, standing in the line and extending my condolences to her parents. I remember walking right by her casket and then viewing a picture of the marker that had been placed on her grave after she'd been buried. So imagine what it was like 2 months later when her mother was awakened in the middle of the night and was told that Whitney was not dead, but had actually been misidentified at the scene of the accident and at that moment was not buried, but actually recuperating in a rehabilitation hospital about 2 hours away. Well, at first, Whitney's mom thought somebody was playing a cruel joke on them. I mean, middle of the night, that kind of news. But it wasn't long before it became apparent that the one who was dead and buried had actually come back to life. And it was wonderful. And you know what? The wonder of that has increased over the years because Whitney, after a long recovery, went on to finish college. She got married. She gave her parents grandchildren. Story two. Over 30 years ago, the doctor told Nancy and me that the baby Nancy was carrying, our first child, had died. And he gave us a choice. He said we could wait for Nancy's system to naturally release the child's body, or we could have her undergo a procedure by which it would be removed. We chose the natural course and sent word out to family and friends, and in turn received all sorts of cards, condolences, expressing grief over the death of our child. Well, Nancy waited. I waited with her. Week, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, a month. More weeks, 2 months. Finally, Nancy goes back into the doctor, having requested a consultation, and upon examining her and having done one of those little sonomatic things or whatever, he took his earbuds out and he said, "Here, listen to this." Who is this? Is this the baby that died? Is this a new baby? What? I'll always remember that day. That wonderful news. Halloween 1994. And you know what? That wonderful news has just become more and more and more wonderful. Is that one who was dead actually went on to grow up and go to school and get a job and is now a contributing part of society and the church. Margaret and Whitney are two of the few persons in this world who possess a stack of condolence cards expressing sorrow over their deaths. But they're not dead. They're very much alive. And every time we come to the table, we remember that we were dead too. But now we're very much alive because Jesus did for us what we could never have done for ourselves. In fact, Jesus himself said, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." So may we all know that. May we all understand that. And may we grow more and more in the wonder of our salvation from sin.